Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon, you're listening to KYRS. The program is Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I'm going to play for you a really awesome interview that I enjoyed and was so happy to do with Jessica Campbell. We recorded this on Friday morning this week. It is now Monday afternoon. Thank you for listening wherever you are. Jessica Campbell is the co-director of the Rural Organizing Project in Oregon. She's also a national leader of Showing Up for Racial Justice. And you'll hear more about both of those organizations and her work in this interview, which is quite long, so I'm going to just get it started without further ado. If you have any questions about the show as you're listening, you can always email me at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at KYRS.org. You can also check out past shows, find the podcast for this if you want to share it with someone else, and all the rest at KYRS.org. So without further ado, here is Jessica Campbell in her own words.
All right. So I'm Jessica Campbell. I'm co-director of the Rural Organizing Project, and I am also out here in Spokane as my capacity as a leadership team member of Showing Up for Racial Justice. And how I got here is a long story. I'll try to think about how to make it short. In high school, my dad had a pretty horrible accident where he fell from an extension ladder, and he ended up breaking a bunch of bones and went into a local hospital that is supposedly ran by a nonprofit, but, you know, they make money hand over fist. And they were really short-staffed, and they put him in the wrong back brace, and it's actually proven that that was why his spinal cord was severed. And he also got MRSA while he was in the hospital. So all throughout high school and pretty much for 5 years, my dad was bedridden. Couldn't get actual health care that was meaningful or actually treated him, because it was all cost prohibitive for the hospital or the insurance company, supposedly. And so I was pretty angry about it all, and I was also pretty angry by what I was seeing going on in the country and feeling pretty powerless as someone who isn't able to vote and someone whose voice was always pretty much ignored. And so I started organizing in my high school. And it started with like a discussion club, and we just talked about current events. It was to the point where we had over 70 people at lunch one day talking about Social Security, where I was just like, what are we doing?
What?
Yeah,
wow.
In high school. It was when the like Social Security debate and should we privatize it was really hot.
Okay.
But
okay.
It's still like high school students talking about Social Security. And mm-hmm. So I just had this moment where I was like, we could be doing so much more than talking. We could just, you know, we have a lot of power as 70 students in a high school of like 300 people. So the next meeting we sat down and said, well, what do we want to do? And people said, well, we have Channel 1 in our high school. Let's get it out. And I don't know if y'all have Channel 1 out here in Spokane.
We don't. I know a little bit about what it is, but why don't you?
Okay.
Yeah, summarize what it is.
It's a basically a corporate-funded, corporate-backed TV program that's supposed to be news-oriented for mm-hmm. high school students, and they really cater to inner-city schools and rural schools, any kind of school district that's really hurting for funding. And the school, in exchange for showing this news program that's actually mostly commercials and really conservative news, they get free TV equipment and AV equipment, so they could have AV classes. So it's a really great deal, actually. But it's in the contract, you're not allowed to let students do anything that could distract them from watching the commercials on the TV. And folks were really annoyed by the horrible coverage. You know, this was during the Bush years. This was during their wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we started a campaign where you clapped every time you saw an ad, which is great because the like supposed news was like, look who won a Grammy. Here's the cover of their CD. You know, it's like that is just an ad pretending to be TV.
Yeah.
And so we did this clapping thing. And it just, I remember like 3 days in, I had a teacher who was really supportive who let me go wander around the school, and I was going up and down the hallways hearing entire classrooms clap every time an ad came up, and I was just like, ooh, you know.
We did this.
Power. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is what power looks like. Mm-hmm. And so they took a vote of the teachers, and all the students had convinced their teachers except for the one AV teacher. The AV teacher said, no, I don't want to lose my job. Mm-hmm. That was the only person who said, let's keep Channel 1. And so we ended up winning. And then we decided to do a walkout against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's actually how I met the Rural Organizing Project. And they resourced me as a local organizer. And I got swept up into their leadership ladder like any good organization. So, and here I am 14 years later.
Wow. So, do you want to, I think let's start with ROP, with Rural Organizing Project, and hear a little bit about what that is and what the model is, because a lot of our listeners to KYRS are in the rural areas of Eastern Washington. We went full power, and now we reach a lot of communities, I think, pretty similar to what you're talking about. So,
awesome. Yeah, so the Rural Organizing Project is, at its core, really a network of over 50 groups that are all autonomous, that are all volunteer, that are doing work to advance democracy in their rural communities, and they all share a commitment to human dignity. And so, you know, ROP started in 1992 in response to an anti-gay ballot measure that would have created second-class citizenship for queers, and it would have written into the Oregon Constitution. And, you know, the founder of ROP wanted to do work on it, wanted to do work on any number of statewide initiatives, and were kept being told by the campaign, well, you could come to Portland to volunteer, or you can send a check. They actually weren't interested in building any kind of local power. So when ballot measure 9 went down at the state level, the religious right behind it, the Oregon Citizens Alliance, decided to move Son of Nine initiatives at municipals and county levels. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, all of the power of a Portland-based urban campaign was taken away. And so Marcy was traveling around the state working with folks to share resources, because there's not enough to go around in rural communities, and to share the strategies that were working in a different community, and maybe that could work in Junction City, and maybe that could work in Cottage Grove. Mm-hmm. And so that was the formation of ROP, was to share information, to pull together resources, to be able to have some collective expertise, and then also to break the isolation that folks are feeling as rural queers and rural progressives.
Yeah, that's amazing. So now that's been in action for a couple decades, right? So what are some other campaigns? Like, how has that changed? Because I'm assuming you take your leadership from, you know, those communities.
Yeah. So our board is all local leaders, and then we're an organization that works from the ground up. So staff, our role is really explicitly to increase the capacity and increase the impact that local groups have on the ground. So we're not actually coming to town and saying, do this, do this, do this. But people on the ground are telling us, you need to tell other groups what's happening here. And maybe there's a campaign where we, like, do some kind of collective action. So one example of that is we did, it was about 5 years ago. It was right after Occupy had kind of kicked off. A bunch of rural communities were getting the news that their rural post offices were going to be closed. And they were communities that are literally hours away from any other post office. They had lost their schools, they had lost their libraries. Literally the only piece of community infrastructure left was a post office. And in many of these communities, they didn't have phone lines that worked, which means that they didn't have dial-up that worked. They certainly didn't have broadband, and they didn't have cell phone reception, so they relied on mail. And it was like a lot of agricultural workers that need to send samples to the USDA. And so a couple of gentlemen called us and said, well, we looked at your website. We see that you're working with, because at the time we had over 30 occupations throughout rural Oregon that were doing encampments or had some kind of organizing in a meaningful way. And so they're saying, well, what if we occupied our post office and actually talked about the fact that that the Postal Service is getting privatized, and that is why we're losing our post offices. And so we said, well, why not? That sounds like fun. Let's try it. Let's see what a friendly occupation looks like, where you bring your postmaster cookies and then you get a bunch of people together to be like, hell no, we're not going to close our post office. And so we put it out there, and then over 24 communities participated in this big action. Wow. And we collected signatures. There were over... there are over 800 signatures collected in that one day, which is just amazing over 8,000 signatures collected in that one day from these very rural communities, largely, that, you know, Deadwood.
That's nearly everybody.
Yeah,
in a
exactly.
few towns. Yeah.
Like a community of Deadwood, 180 people were in town that day. 164 showed up for the rally. Like everyone knew and they counted by the signatures. And it was to the point where, you know, our senators went on the Senate floor with photos of rural post offices being like, we cannot lose this last piece of community infrastructure, which is like the probably the first and only time Deadwood, Oregon, or Gentura, Oregon, are going to be on the Senate floor, talked about as though they matter.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. And that's also what I've liked, you know, just these last couple of days, learning more about ROP and learning more about what you do. I think that rural people get scapegoated a lot, but also get the brunt in the same way that, you know, that inner cities and neighborhoods like that do, really get the brunt of bad policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in cities, if things get privatized, like, you'll notice because there will be a FedEx on your block instead of a post office, but there won't be nothing, right? So I think that a lot of, you know, poor white people, poor people of all races, but particularly rural people are being scapegoated for the success of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Right now. How have you seen that dynamic play out in rural Oregon, and where are your people on that?
Yeah. Well, our people are terrified of Trump. That's where they're at. I mean, it's, you know, we definitely are. We've done a lot of work for a long time in Oregon, so I feel like the urban-rural divide looks different here than it does in a lot of other states where, you know, it's just horrific. But we still have the dynamic where we have a Democratic majority in the legislature. We do have a Democrat for governor. There's a Democrat administration, but yet the rest of the state, by and large, is red. Mm-hmm. And over two-thirds of the local seats are held by Republicans or conservatives, if it's a nonpartisan seat. And so it's very much a situation where rural Oregon has been completely disregarded by political leadership for a very long time. But right now, under a supposed progressive kind of majority, we're seeing, well, they get what they vote for. You know, if they can't do their own voting and their own interests, like, what are we supposed to do? They're just not smart enough to figure it out. They get what they deserve. And, you know, that is getting real old, you know, for a lot of us that are seeing communities fall apart. And, you know, we have communities that don't have 911 dispatch that's 24 hours a day. So people are turning to paramilitaries, and that's just unacceptable. And no one at the state level seems to be tracking. But in terms of Trump, you know, we saw a whole heck of a lot of our folks who are progressively minded, terrified of him. And then their neighbors who are conservative, also terrified of him.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of folks that were really hoping for like a Kasich win that did not happen in the primary. And there's a lot of Republicans that we have seen that are saying like, and they're writing into their local newspaper saying, I hate Hillary Clinton, but I will vote for her before I vote for Donald Trump. Please, as a lifelong Republican, do not make me vote for Hillary Clinton. And then that's the boat that they're in right now. So, you know, I think what is also interesting about Trump is that there's real resonance with the paramilitary folks that we have out in Oregon right now. We have probably the most developed militia movement in Oregon than any other state, as far as we can tell. And we have over 40 groups throughout the state that are doing their thing locally, and they're doing a lot of electoral work, and then they're doing work to undermine that electoral work and to undermine local democracy. And we're actually seeing that the county Republican Party system is getting taken over, and we've also seen that the state Republican Party now has militia leaders as delegates for Trump that went to the RNC. So that's pretty scary that they are building up a base and building up power and infrastructure within the Republican Party to try and shift it to the right.
Yeah. And we were talking before about the ways that, you know, you've been on this tour with ROP going around Oregon to talk about the militia movement. And I think ROP is releasing a book about the topic, which you can talk about too. But, you know, you said you had been kind of criticized for that, and you're like, I'm giving them compliments. Like, they have organized really well. And can you describe a little bit more? Because I think we have some of the same dynamics in Washington. There just aren't. And we're just very similar, I think.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that we have Spokane on this side as kind of this, like, micro urban center that that creates a second dot on the map when you look at the map, but those dynamics are really present. So how does that work, and how did this happen? You know, like how did Oregon specifically get to the point of having 40 different paramilitary groups?
Yeah. So how Oregon got there? So maybe I'll start in kind of chronological order. So about 4 or 5 years ago, we saw a bunch of rural counties that were really reliant on timber extraction to support their local economies, or was like the heart of their local economy. Previously, they lost their federal timber payments, which was passed by Congress. It was a 25-year timber payment program that was intended to keep rural community infrastructure afloat, specifically sheriff's departments, which don't only provide law enforcement, but also provide like any kind of response to natural disasters. So mudslides, tornado, whatever it might be, they're supposed to be the ones who respond first and foremost, and then they can escalate to the state or to a federal level. And so once those cuts happened, it took counties a long time, actually. It takes a lot of work to pass a safety levy. It takes a long time to then, like, build up the support for a new tax. And there were multiple counties that didn't pass any new taxes. And we later found out that it was paramilitary leadership in the lead of a lot of these no new taxes campaigns. And these paramilitary leadership are also standing up and saying, look, our police won't serve us. They can't serve us. They can't even pass this tax. So they were creating a situation and then pointing at it as though they were the solution to the situation that they're creating. Very smart electioneering, very smart. And so as a result, as I mentioned before, we have communities where they don't have 24-hour 911 dispatch, where you call and it just rings. Or you call and you get an answering machine saying, try again at 9 a.m. So, or you do get a dispatcher, but there's no law enforcement. And in rural communities, law enforcement intervenes in domestic violence situations. Like, law enforcement will often respond if there's like a cat in a tree, you know, like, it's not just like responding to criminal activity. It's some pretty critical community infrastructure in a lot of ways too. And so if we, you know, I told a story at the PGL's luncheon about, a women's crisis worker in Josephine County, which is southwestern Oregon, who was talking about taking a client to get a restraining order against an abusive ex. And the judge said, well, I can grant you this restraining order, but we don't have any police to enforce it. Do you have a gun? Do you know how to get your concealed carry license? Like, you're going to have to enforce this yourself. And just telling survivors that, I mean, it's just really stark. So what we've seen is, as everyone probably saw in the headlines, we saw this national mobilization of people around the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge occupation. And what a lot of folks didn't know is that a very similar occupation happened of a gold mine a year prior, April 2015, in Josephine County. And it was really an opportunity for people across the country who believed in this movement to come together to network and to build. And it's very strategic what they did. You know, they have very savvy media people who know how to put out a narrative that doesn't alarm tons of people and withholds a lot of information except for right-wing media. So local folks weren't sure what was going on and were terrified into silence. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they like do all of this civic engagement work or community service work to appear to be just veterans organizations. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, if the rhetoric internally is that they want a civil war and they want to take down the federal government, mm-hmm. if they're building wheelchair ramps for people who wouldn't mm-hmm. otherwise have accessible homes, or they're building playground equipment, or they're providing the mentorship through the mentorship programs at the high schools. So we saw the building of these groups, and a big part of it is because Idaho 3%ers came over and whipped Oregon 3%ers into shape, because they were like, we share an identity, let us teach you how we built structure. And then we have seen a whole heck of a lot of really good organizing where people are speaking to the fact that we have political leadership that has neglected rural communities. We have veterans who are returning and can't find work, or finding work that's really crappy and doesn't mm-hmm. actually fulfill them and doesn't actually feed their families. I mean, it's the same reason why we're seeing suicide rates mm-hmm. spike amongst white workers right now, is because people are not fulfilled by what's going on in the economy and they feel like they're a burden. I mean, this is happening in my community. There have been multiple suicides in recent years where people just felt like, especially, you know, like younger white men felt like they didn't have any worth because they couldn't find any work. And this movement really taps into that and speaks to that and says, this is wrong. We're going to change things by taking this stuff down. And you can be a part of it. And you can be a hero. You could be a hero that brings your community through this really dark time. And it really resonates with people who are feeling lost. It gives people a political home that gives them hope and inspiration.
Wow. And before we continue into how we progressive people or lefties or however you want to identify have failed, I think it's a safe to say that we have not done that as well. I'll just remind listeners that you're listening to Praxis, you're listening to KYRS Thin Air Community Radio, and I am in the studio recording this Friday morning with Jessica Campbell, who is co-director of the Rural Organizing Project in Oregon and on the national leadership team of Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice. And we'll get to that stuff in a minute. But we've been talking about the rise of the militia movement in Oregon. And yeah, what did we not do during that time? And how, I guess, can people in those communities who don't share those values of launching into civil war go forward, you know, when that's already the situation?
Well, I think a huge piece of this, and this is me doing a little bit of navel gazing, but also a little bit of identifying as someone who grew up working class and, you know, food insecure, is that I believe that, like, working class rural Oregonians were really neglected. We've already seen that progressive infrastructure in the state and nationally goes to urban areas. You know, the funding for good work, I mean, you all know, Spokane, how often do you all get funded? It's a real struggle. Mm-hmm. It's a real struggle. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that there's just like whoever controlling the money, controlling the or making the decisions about who gets funded, who gets infrastructure, who gets support, has neglected rural, deciding it's too hard, deciding it's not worth it, deciding that the concentration of people's like not worth trying to do a canvas or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, that means that rural has really been left as an uncompeted for base for the right in a lot of parts of the country. And particularly rural working class people who are struggling. And the power of the Patriot Movement, I believe, is because they have tapped into the fact that people are deeply unsatisfied with mm-hmm. their economic reality, which is something the left should be talking about, frankly. Right. Like, if we're talking about income and inequality, like, we should be talking about the fact that the sawmill owners are screwing over employees. Like, there was just recently this article, I think it was in the LA Times, that was about a young man in Cave Junction, Oregon, and it was meant to be like a profile of a stupid Trump voter. And he talked about how he was working at this sawmill. He got laid off. He decided to go to school. And he took out all these loans to go to school. He was midterm when the sawmill owner came and told him, hey, we retooled. Why don't you come back to the mill? We can guarantee that you'll have, I think it was at least 1 year of work. And he was only at work a couple months before he was laid off again. And he was blaming Obama for it. And he, like, there are photos in this article of him sitting there with the sawmill owner, like they're buddies, and blaming Obama for the fact that he got laid off. And people across the country were just like, well, this stupid Oregonian, you know, this stupid rural person, like, of course he's voting for Trump. He's an idiot. Instead of really acknowledging the fact that there is a cycle, especially in natural resource extraction-based economies, to just exploit labor over and over again, and that it is also has a political cycle to it, where you scapegoat people of color, immigrants, refugees, you know, people on public assistance, whatever, you scapegoat people. And
whoever's
that's how you
not the owner of the mill.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. In order to get in, who's going to vote for the interests of the owner of the mill? I mean, it's just, it's a really predictable cycle. And we've seen it for generations in Oregon now, and I'm sure in Washington, too. And, you know, our inability as progressives to really talk about that, to address that, and then to really dig in with folks about what are concrete solutions. You know, that's the thing, is these paramilitary groups are coming in and being like, you can't rely on police. Well, what do you know? We have a structure for that, and it's called a militia. And what you need to do is you need to organize with your neighbors. And people get that community building piece really intrinsically, like it speaks to their souls, and it escalates. And, you know, we've been contacted by communities who are like, it started with get to know your neighbors, create like a little bit of a community network. Okay, now do armed patrols for town. And people are kind of like, okay, not really into that, but okay. And then it escalated to now you should go patrol the national forest because there are, and I'm paraphrasing, undocumented people cooking meth. And it's your job to get rid of them. And people were just like, whoa, whoa, like, what is this? Who, like, I thought we were doing this for our neighbors. Like, we're not patrolling the forests. But you could see where if you are, like, bought into the scapegoating and the stereotype about brown people, why it would be really easy for a vulnerable community to be fed this line that they need to be driven out of town, which is just thinly veiled white nationalism. It just is. So, you know, they're pragmatically organizing to meet people's insecurities and needs, which is... We should be doing that.
I mean, imagine going in and saying, let's, instead of saying, oh, there's no police, saying, oh, there's no jobs. What if we update and collectivize this infrastructure in your town? You know, what if we put in X industry? Like, what is there? What could there be? Let's have, you know. And then what's funny about it, I think, is that people on the right would hear that and be like, see, it's the socialist threat.
Yeah,
but like, yeah, it is. It just isn't a threat because we aren't, you know, quite as organized. But I think you're probably going in at a good moment when people are starting to have trepidation, starting to see, especially with Trump, with like the veil is coming off of the thinly veiled white nationalism. And I think that there are people who, people of conscience who are in those situations who don't want to be part of that story.
Yeah,
but we haven't really provided... People don't know their own history also, and I think that's a big part of it too, which kind of leads back into the race element of the equation. So do you want to talk a little bit about Surge and what white people organizing for racial justice looks like to you?
Sure. Yeah. So Surge is showing up for racial justice, and it is a national network of over 150 chapters and affiliated organizations that are all committed to doing some level of bringing white people into the work for racial justice in the vision of having a strong multiracial majority that are all organizing for justice together. And Surge really saw its, you know, its, I'm going to use the word surge. I can't think of another word, not enough coffee. Surge really saw its membership surge in, after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson out in Ferguson. And, you know, watching, you know, Mike Brown's mom sob once that non-indictment came down on the live stream just really woke up a bunch of white folks that were like, whoa, we did not expect that to happen. Mm-hmm. And of course, people of color were like, we were totally expecting that to happen. How many times has that happened before? Countless mm-hmm. times. And so what Surge did was Surge really pulled together these massive conference calls. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people were getting on these conference calls being like, I'm white. I have some white neighbors I've been talking to about this stuff, but I don't really know what to do. Mm-hmm. And then organizers from Ferguson were like, listen, your anxiety is not going to get me free. It has mm-hmm. nothing to do with my liberation. You need to get out there, even if you're just standing on the corner of your street with a sign and be visible, mm-hmm. visibly in action, visibly opposed to this, and start conversations. That's the number one thing that needs to be happening. You need to move. And people were really terrified of messing up. People were really terrified of doing something wrong, mm-hmm. which is, you know, typical white people. Mm-hmm. And Maurice was just like, you know what? That's okay. You're going to mess up and you're going to learn from it. And then you're going to do it again better. That is what this is going to be. And that is really what Surge is rooted in, is accountability through action, making sure that people are not just getting smarter or developing their analysis in a bubble where they get to be superior and they get to be super smart, you know, anti-racist whitey, but they get to be, you know, organizers that are on the ground, probably messing up, but learning mm-hmm. and building a bigger and bigger base for racial justice in their communities.
Oh, that's awesome. When you said that last night at the workshop, Jessica put on a workshop last night for Peace and Justice Action League, and you said something about the goal. You're talking about accountability through action. You're like, it's about more than being the smartest person in the room. That was like, whew, that like really hit me right, you know, in a like central region somewhere, because I think it's easy to fall into that, and to and I think especially kind of the internet expression of mm-hmm. social justice culture is all about, you know, knowing more than the other person mm-hmm. and call out culture, which is something we've talked about some on the show. So I really like that that's an explicit focus.
Yeah, it's speaks to my soul mm-hmm. because for a lot of years, you know, and you know, it's across social justice work, it's across progressive movements where like white folks speak over voices of color and the experiences of people of color and, you know, talk about racial justice in this like really brainy, theoretical, mm-hmm. like way that's not really practical. And it's really not practical, frankly, for rural people and like my people that feel like because they might not have a college education that they're excluded from those conversations. And so Surge has really been an incredible resource to those of us at ROP and like my people as rural Oregonians to really, especially working class Oregonians, to talk about race in a way mm-hmm. that isn't like this super brainiac mental exercise, but it's actually talking about like what kind of community do you want and what role are you going to play, you know. And we have people in our network that are like really proud of being anti-racist rednecks. Like they're going to be redneck in a different way mm-hmm. and it is not flying a Confederate flag and it is not buying into the white nationalist BS going on mm-hmm. nationally. Like they are proud to be working class, they're proud to be like farmers, they're proud to be Okies, and they are going to tell you what's up and they're going to organize with their brothers and sisters of color in their community to change things.
Mm-hmm. That is, yeah, that's awesome. I love hearing that. And I hope that people hear it as an invitation out there in the world also as you're listening. And it's okay to fail and then just try again. So I forgot, I want to kind of backtrack actually a little bit to the book that you all are working on. Can you tell me about how it became a book and like when the moment was you'd realized, oh, we need to write a book about this?
Yeah. So the moment that we realized we needed to do something to capture what was going on was right after April 2015, which is when there was a national mobilization of paramilitary groups to Josephine County. And there was just very, very little media coverage. Locally, nationally, there was close to none. And so we knew we needed to write something because we had mapped out, as part of just trying to respond to people feeling unsafe in Josephine County, we were trying to map out who was coming. We realized that there was a lot of organizing that was happening under our noses, and a lot of national organizing that, frankly, the Southern Poverty Law Center and the other organizations that typically track, and there's a whole bunch of monitoring organizations that have since gone, you know, they've closed their doors because that work isn't funded the same way it used to be. And so no one was really paying attention to what was happening in Oregon or in a lot of states, really, around this movement. And so we went, okay, we have all this information, we've collected it all, like, we're telling our base about it, but how do we actually get it out there broader? Because we know that there are other states that are probably seeing the same, maybe not as developed, but they're probably seeing the same level of organizing and responding to similar, especially in the West, similar circumstances in the communities. So we started writing this toolkit that was meant to be like, you know, a little bit of history, a little bit of economic analysis about, like, what's the moment that this populist movement is responding to, and then tools for organizers who might find themselves in the same situation. And so we were pretty far along when the occupation of the refuge started, and then all of a sudden we got all of this just bananas national attention that all of a sudden people really cared about rural Oregon for like 5 minutes because a bunch of fake cowboys from out of state came into town and pretended to be us and spoke for us. And so we really learned about how they had intentionally come in. They had like pretended to set up elected bodies that were supposed to be private county commissions. And then, like, their spokesperson goes to the community meeting and says that they were appointed by Ammon Bundy himself. You know, it's just like themselves, they were admitting that they're an anti-democratic structure. And so we went, oh, we really have to retool this thing. So it just recently released, I think it was 2 weeks ago, we released it. And it's called Up in Arms, A Guide to Oregon's Patriot Movement. It's for free on our website if you go to ROP.org. We did it in collaboration with our friends at Political Research Associates, which is a social justice-oriented think tank on the right. And they really work alongside groups that are doing the work on the ground. And so we've been really fortunate to be friends with PRA for a long time. And they jumped in with us and helped us develop this toolkit. Wow. So it's not just ROP that did it. It was also people with real expertise around tracking the right for decades. And so we just released it. We just did a big tour around the state where we were talking to 10 communities that are on the front lines of the militia movement, where we had militia leadership in the room as we were talking about the toolkit and talking about their movement. And it was just, it's been really interesting seeing people respond to this. Now it's a book. You know, we had intended for it to be like a pamphlet, maybe, like, or maybe a magazine, like maybe 50 pages.
Just like
now it's like 250 pages. Dang, and we were like, we need an index, you know. So hopefully it will be a comprehensive resource for anyone who might want to dig in a little bit or a lot. It should hopefully be something for everyone there.
Wow. And I'll put the link to that in the podcast notes. So if people are listening after the fact, they can download it and read it and check it out. I'll also put all anything else that we reference and links like that there. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS Thin Air Community Radio, talking with Jessica Campbell, co-director of Rural Organizing Project in Oregon and on the national leadership team of Showing Up for Racial Justice. If you missed the beginning of our talk and want to hear it, you can find the podcast by going to kyrs.org and navigating to shows, Praxis, following the links there, or you can go directly to subscribe to the podcast at soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO. And I wanted to ask you, kind of in this last third that we have, I've been really overwhelmed by the prospect of, in this whole Trump campaign, but even before that, knowing that, you know, there's people in my family, I'm from like a working class rural background also, there's a lot of people in my family who get their information from like an entirely different world than I am connected to. And there's also a, I think, a really intentional strategic level of wordplay and stuff going on in the right, and just this ability through Fox News, but through other, through InfoWars, mm-hmm. even like Breitbart, you know, the rest, to just say, oh, this person said a thing, but that was a lie, and what they mean is my message. My, mm-hmm. you know, how have you seen, I don't know, I mean, how do you come back against that, and how can communities, like, assert factual reality around us in the face of just this surreal denial of reality?
I mean, that is, that's like a million-dollar question, and I don't think I necessarily have any answers, but we're also experimenting with this because, as ROP, releasing this toolkit and then going on tour, like, we have people who created flyers calling ROP Nazis, saying that we're funded by Nazis, which is just, you know, a joke, really. And it's hard to argue with people that refuse to, like, we printed up all of the foundations that we've gotten money from. And we were like, there are no Nazis on this list, you know? Mm-hmm. But you can't argue facts with some of these folks. And part of it is just a condition of, and especially within the right, they have so much media that you are able to really, if you wanted to, just be completely swallowed up by it. You know, you could just choose to only listen to right-wing media all day, every day. There's so much content. And we saw that out at the Refuge. You know, Pete Santilli was out there and he was podcasting and live streaming constantly mm-hmm. with his, like, narrative, you know, on top of it. And of course, it was a narrative that, like, totally interpreted things goofy, like the FBI was coming to kill everyone, you know, the police are doing this, that, and the other. And if you reinforce the narrative enough times, you don't actually... facts don't seem to matter a whole lot. And then you mentioned, you know, like the right talks about our coded language, and then we talk about the right's dog whistle politics. Mm-hmm. You know, they say law and order, and it actually is anti-immigrant. You know, mm-hmm. what are those other dog whistle politics? And it's a huge thing that needs to be overcome when people get siloed that way, especially mm-hmm. in rural communities, when people get siloed that way, because it means that temperatures are going to rise. Neighbors aren't talking to each other the way that they used to be or should be. You know, people are unfriending each other on Facebook. And so you end up having a siloed Facebook mm-hmm. feed of just, like, what reinforces your worldview. And I honestly think, you know, what we are experimenting with, and it seems to be working fairly well, is really getting people in the room together intentionally. You know, you might say something really snotty to your neighbor on Facebook that you would never say to their face. Mm-hmm. Like, you, if you ran into them in the grocery store, at the post office, you would not call them a name or tell yeah. them they're an idiot because you don't agree with what they're saying. And so we're, like, working with communities that in many cases are on the front lines of the militia movement to have community meetings that actually have nothing to do with politics, that have nothing to do with the militia movement, but instead are, like, talking about the fact that food insecurity is a thing. And maybe we should have a farmer's market so we can actually guarantee some level of access to food. And it's intentionally a security strategy for the folks who are organizing this, because then they're seen as human. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of what's perpetuated in the media is, or in social media, is that these people who are organizing against the militias are Nazis, you know, they're secret socialists, they're horrible people. And in reality, they're teachers and mm-hmm. daycare providers and, you know, single moms that care deeply about their community. So being able to put that in a room and have people meet face to face and really pull away a yeah. lot of the nastiness that is being talked about online is going to lower temperatures. Mm-hmm. And I know that that is, like, deeply unsatisfying for people that, like, want a solution before the election, because that requires a lot of organizing right yeah, now. But you know, it's to a point where, at least in Oregon, a lot of places in Oregon, that the temperatures are so high that that's exactly what we need to do in order to de-escalate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what do you think? So I think that Spokane is, and this is your first time here, but I think that you know the dynamic. I was talking to Joe Pakotis 2 weeks ago, and he said, you know, honestly, he said Spokane might as well be rural. Which kind of blew my mind, because I'm used to thinking of as being more of an urban dynamic within a rural surrounding. And we are, so we're a little bit of both here. And I wonder what the strategy can be for that when it's a lot easier to silo yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't really have to see anyone you deeply disagree with outside of your workplace, where mm-hmm. most workplaces, like, you're not supposed to be really talking about politics anyway. It trickles in. How do you think that kind of strategy could translate into mm-hmm. somewhere like Spokane?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, like, when you're in a city that has access to, like, public transportation and, you know, the level of infrastructure is just so different. And I know that there's a lot of folks that come into Spokane from the rural areas mm-hmm. that, like, it's their hub for organizing. It's their hub for political activity. It feels like it's a hub for, you know, like, you do your grocery shopping mm-hmm. or you come to get your excellent coffee or whatever.
Any social service also.
Mm,
yeah.
Gotcha.
So you're conduit into any state-based services most of the time.
Mm, that makes a lot of sense. Well, I mean, if that's the case around services, we have seen a lot of folks do good organizing around people who are coming in for WIC mm-hmm. or coming into, like, the DHS office for child care support or those kinds of things. And actually really sitting down with folks and having conversations. And I've done it before. It was years ago. But, you know, we had a survey that was talking about, like, you know, how are you feeling about current events right now? And talking to people mm-hmm. who no one has asked them about yeah. what their opinion is about what's going on in the world. And it's really empowering for people. I mean, mm-hmm. women who are single moms, who are struggling to get by, who are, you know, there's enough shame around being on public assistance, which is horrific that we are in that state. But nonetheless, you know, asking them what their political opinions are and what they're most concerned about in the world right now is empowering. And I just, you know, you watch people, like, light up that someone cares mm-hmm. about what they have to say. I just feel like that is the core of the work that I want to be doing moving forward is who is actually disenfranchised by this moment, who is being scapegoated in this moment. Mm-hmm. Like, how did those folks feel and where are they at and where can we actually find some common ground? And how do we actually use what we hear to really develop what kind of work we're doing as progressives or as lefties or as however you identify radicals yeah. or whatever to actually, you know, I think the bottom line of the rhetoric on the left has always been about people power mm-hmm. and, you know, holding up those who are most vulnerable. And this is a moment where, you know, it's clear that's not happening and we need to start doing the hard work of yeah. bringing those people in now.
Yeah. And so what would, just in our last few minutes, what would you recommend to people listening who aren't active in organizing or activism, but who really are, like, feeling this moment mm-hmm. or like, oh, what do I do? what's your advice to someone who's maybe in that position right now, who wants to get past the stage of posting things on Facebook and being in the Facebook trenches?
Oh. Excellent. Well, at both ROP and Surge, our number one priority is actually building up locally based groups of people who are doing, you know, taking action or developing political analysis amongst their friends and neighbors. And so that would be where I would start is, who are your neighbors? Who are your friends? Who could you start talking to about getting together in a living room and having a conversation about what's going on? And it might be a ballot party. It might be, you know, you just want to sit down with some, you know, coffee or maybe a beer just to, like, chat through what's going on in the world and start a group. Start a group that is really intentionally, like, building together to move forward, even if it's just, you know, it's a support group, mm-hmm. which a lot of our folks, like, feel like their local organizing in their group is their support group, as especially, like, lefties in rural Oregon that feel isolated. That is how they, you know, hone their political analysis and get their, you know, political, you know, activity in, and they feel better as human beings by doing it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're not interested in forming a group, there's a number of organizations across Spokane. I don't know about the rural areas surrounding Spokane, but, you know, Pajals is incredible. ROP has always thought of PAGELS as a sister organization in many ways in terms of how the work is done and how it really responds to what people are most passionate about in the community or any crises that are coming up. Definitely jump in, show up at the office and say you want to volunteer. Mm-hmm. Sit down with a local leader and ask them more and see if you can get involved. I mean, this is a moment where, you know, it's great if folks want to do individual action, but it's actually organizing with a group of people that is has always been how social change has happened. Mm-hmm. And this is the moment to join up.
Yeah. And I love the idea of just support groups being necessary. Because I've kind of gone through this process of being really frustrated with that, with people showing up to organizing meetings, like campaign meetings, wanting to process their feelings about current events and being like, we don't have time. This is an hour-long meeting. Mm-hmm. And really being in that, like, perfectionist headspace you described of, like, we have stuff to get done, which is true, you know, but it's also, I think it shows that that part has been neglected in certain ways. Of just letting people come out, really. It's a coming out process. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that on coming out day, not to hijack that energy from queer people and that specific coming out struggle. But I think to politically come out is really intimidating for people. And because the left has cultivated this culture of who knows more, people tell me all the time, like, I want to do something, but I can't talk about this. Like, I don't know the right words. I'm going to mess up. And it's a real thing. So even building up the courage, especially in a rural area or a family that doesn't talk about this kind of stuff, to have that support to say, like, well, I think that I'm anti-capitalist, but I don't know if I can say that yet. But, oh, you know, Marcy or, you know, Jessica will back me up. Mm-hmm. Like knowing who your allies are. Who have supported you in building that is just huge. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, what I have always done, and I know a lot of folks like come to me, you know, right after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson, it was right before Thanksgiving. And I remember I was going to the grocery store to get a bunch of groceries, or it wasn't a bunch of groceries. I think I needed to get like peppers and like onions. And it took 3 hours to get out of the store because everyone I knew was jumping on me, being like, I don't know how I feel. I feel very conflicted about what's going on in Ferguson. I feel like the media isn't telling me the truth, and I'm not really sure. Like, can you explain? Can we talk about this? And, you know, it was people who were coming forward who have never really been politically oriented before that were alarmed by what they were seeing and knew that they didn't have perfect language and were really, really nervous that, like, I was going to jump on them or yell at them, but they still did it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think because they knew I wasn't going to jump on them and yell at them. And, you know, Surge is definitely in this position right now of trying to figure out how to resource having those conversations for the first time. And Surge has put together these really cute placemats for, I think it was Labor Day and 4th of July, where it was like, here's your placemat to talk about race on the 4th of July. Let's talk about Independence Day and let's talk about racial justice while you're at your barbecue or your picnic with your family. So, you know, I don't think those tools are perfect, but they're a good starting place for folks who are a little bit nervous and might need a nudge.
Yeah. We should have that. I think I'll try to organize a like Thanksgiving rehearsal dinner. That would be so fun. I think we should do that. Like, I'll be your racist uncle and you can practice not yelling at your uncle and calling him a racist, but hearing where he's at.
Brilliant. And not just like shutting down and being like, oh my God, Uncle Bob is doing that again, but actually engaging.
Yeah.
Oof. Love it.
That's somewhere I'm not there yet. Like, I hear that. But I have people who I'm just like, you're next. Like, I'm on the first tier. I'm on the people who are in my family. Like, I'll go talk to strangers all day, but not my family. So
yeah, that's real.
Yeah.
That's
Is there real. Anything else? Do you have like a favorite story or something you want to make sure that people hear about before we wrap up?
Favorite story. It's so hard to choose. I have so many favorites. I started talking about post offices, and maybe I'll end talking about post offices. Even though this is an older campaign, I think it just has such resonance in this moment because it was really a whole bunch of folks that would organize together, even though they were totally different places on the political spectrum. So out in Summer Lake, which is in Lake County. It's southern Oregon. It's almost southeastern Oregon. I think it is southeastern Oregon. And these incredible folks heard that their post office was going to be closed, and so they started organizing. They got a whole bunch of people whipped up because the Postal Service, what they would do, it was a really bad top-down strategy to pretend that they were being democratic about the closure of these post mm-hmm. offices. So they said that they sent out surveys to everyone, and they almost never sent out surveys to everyone in the community. And then they would have these community meetings where they would just talk and they wouldn't actually listen. And so in Summer Lake, they organized, they raffled off a $50 gas card, which is how much it would cost in gas to get to the nearest post office and back from Summer Lake. And so they got a whole bunch of people into the room. And then they had a retired state trooper or retired sheriff actually block the doors and not let the USPS representative out of the room. And he facilitated the meeting. He took the control away from the Postal Service, and people were prepared with testimony about their post office is actually a lot more than selling stamps. Mm-hmm. It is the only living wage job with benefits in the community. It is the only place where people can organize if there's a natural disaster. And people were telling story after story about in, you know, icy, snowy eastern Oregon about how difficult and treacherous it would be to drive to the nearest post office to do all of the business that they have to do. And so what ended up happening is these people just felt totally empowered. You know, and we heard stories from people who said that they were good Republicans and they don't actually believe that they should tell businesses what to do. But here they are. They're going to mm-hmm. tell this like semi-business, semi-private entity what to do. And what ended up happening out of all of that were, you know, and they had beautiful signs up with all of their research, and they did their own surveying and mm-hmm. polled their own community and said, actually, you didn't talk to us, and here's what we really have yeah. to say. And they ended up not only keeping their post office, they got an increase in hours.
Wow.
So the only living wage job with benefits actually saw an increase in hours, and they actually saw an increase in services because they organized across political lines and wow. turned out just about everyone in the community.
Wow. Let's get going then. Jeez. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking yeah. time with all of us this week, but with me this morning. And again, if you're just joining us at the end, I've been talking with Jessica Campbell. She's the co-director of Rural Organizing Project, which is at www.rop.org, and also on the leadership national leadership team of SURGE, Showing Up for Racial Justice, which I believe the website is showingupforracialjustice.org,
mm-hmm.
all spelled out. The local SURGE affiliate is PJALS, so you can find SURGE information in Spokane through the Peace and Justice Action League at peacejustice.org. And I think that's all. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For your time.
Appreciate it.
And if you're just joining me at the end, you can find the podcast at soundcloud.com/praxisradio. You can also email me with any questions at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at KYRS.org. Thanks for listening. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.